Our neighbors to the north in Wisconsin are considering making it legal for children of any age to carry a gun while hunting. Here's Republican Representative Rob Staffschult.
If you don't think they're ready under the age of 10, then please don't take them. This gives the choice back to the parent.
And it's been exactly 100 years since the Bolshevik Revolution that shook the world. We're talking to University of Illinois history professor and author Mark Steinberg.
So, you know, at the bottom level of society, for most people, the main thing they remember, it was a catastrophe. It was tragedy. People suffered, and there were a lot of bad politicians. And sometimes when people are saying that, I think they're saying, and look at it now.
But first, as it gets dark earlier and rainy or cold days lead to treacherous road conditions, a look at cycling safety throughout Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Fall's great for many things, but if you're an avid cyclist, you know, especially after daylight saving time ends, we hit a danger zone of darker days, sidewalks slick with rain, or even icy roads. Which, by the way, we've got rain and lots of chilly temps in the forecast for later this week, especially near the lake. The most recent data doesn't paint a pretty picture for us either. In the suburbs of Chicago, for example, the Illinois Department of Transportation says that fatal vehicle collisions with bikers and pedestrians are up nearly 13%. That's from 2015, the most recent data available. So what can you do if you're a cyclist, and what can the state do better to improve conditions? We're going to be taking a look at cycling all across the state with the nonprofit Ride Illinois and a bike shop owner in Champaign. But let's start with the part of Illinois that has the most cyclists, the Chicago area. I'm joined now by Marnie Pike. She's a transportation reporter with the Daily Herald and analyzed IDOT's data on bike collisions. She's on the line with us from Downers Grove. Hi, Marnie. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. I'm a big NPR fan, so I'm happy to be on.
Great. Thank you. You know, the Daily Herald, you all counted more than 9,000 vehicle crashes with pedestrians and cyclists. That's in the Chicago suburbs between 2012 to 2015. Out of those 9,000 crashes, unfortunately, 250 fatalities. What to you was most significant about these numbers?
Well, to me, and our newspaper, we report on all of these crashes, you know, and it was striking to us, you know, how frequently they're occurring, fatalities and crashes with injuries. So we wanted to take a deeper dive. And to me, one interesting thing was that, you know, the Active Transportation Alliance calls it stubborn crash rates. The fact is that they're not decreasing in spite of efforts like bike paths and, you know, pedestrian islands and other ways to make people safer. There's a continual increase in crashes. They were up 3% in 2015 from 2014, which is according to the most recent IDOT data we have. So to me, it was striking how, you know, it's just inevitable, it seems, that, you know, every week you're going to get a serious crash.
And do we have a sense of why these crashes are happening? Is this because of, and I'm thinking within the city of Chicago, I wonder how much things have changed since Mayor Rahm Emanuel has introduced clear bike lanes. That's a lot clearer now. This data is from 2012 to 2015. So I know that communities have done a lot of improvements over the past couple of years. Do we have a sense of why? Is there a sense of a pattern of why most of these accidents are happening?
That's a great question, and there are myriad answers. You know, first of all, there's a big push to get more people walking and cycling, you know, because we're trying to combat obesity. You also have a trend of, you know, more drivers on the road as the economy improves. So you've got those odds. Then in the suburbs particularly, you know, you'd think they're a bucolic place for people to cycle or walk, but really we have a lot of high-speed, high-volume roads. You know, like North Avenue or Route 83, where, you know, you could say you're taking your life in your hands to cycle along there. There's, there's a lack of sidewalks in some areas. I have to say, if there's one takeaway I hope people get from this series, is to stop for pedestrians in crosswalks. Illinois in 2010.
Cyclists and drivers is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. There was a law put in Illinois requiring drivers to, you know, stop for pedestrians when they're in crosswalks, but you know, they aren't, and that was the cause of one of the fatalities that we mentioned in the series. I'd also say there's a lot of distracted drivers out there, and, you know, some distracted cyclists and walkers as well. So those are just a few of the reasons.
And what have you reported on in terms of communities improving the situation, Marnie?
Well, there are communities who are doing a lot. I mean, and counties, too, as part of this effort to, you know, promote a more healthy lifestyle. There's, you know, in some of the older suburbs, like in DuPage County, there's like great network of bike trails. And, you know, other towns are trying to do that. Arlington Heights just approved a comprehensive bike plan. But I will say one of the problems with these great bike trails is when they end. Or, you know, there's gaps in the system, and so people are spilled out onto, you know, busy streets. Now, the engineering is a huge component. You know, communities like Bensonville, I want to say they're building bike trails there to make it safer. And there's people are putting – towns like Mount Prospect put in a crosswalk to make a dangerous – street that's near a park where there are a lot of, you know, incidents of fast cars and near misses with pedestrians. They put in a crosswalk with flashing amber lights to try to, you know, make sure drivers stopped for people crossing. But that was a place where there was actually a fatal crash. So, you know, there's you know, efforts, you know, just to traffic calming. That some suburbs are doing, you know, pedestrian islands and those kind of engineering solutions.
Right. Engineering solutions, as well as the whole idea of just everyone on the road, whether they're cyclists, pedestrians, or drivers, paying attention to their conditions, which is an important part of this. Marnie Pike covers transportation. She's also a projects writer for the Daily Herald. Marnie, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to Ed Barsotti. He's the Chief Programs Officer for the nonprofit organization Ride Illinois. He's on the line with us from Aurora. And in our studios in Urbana is James Radel. He's the owner of Neutral Cycle in Champaign. Hi, Ed. Hi, James. Thanks for being with us.
Hello.
Good morning.
Ed, as we've been hearing about some of the safety challenges riders in Illinois are facing, specifically in the suburbs, I wonder how that compares to the rest of the state.
You know, what happens in the suburbs happens in a lot of the smaller metro areas around the state as well. They're very similar conditions. And Marnie mentioned issues such as the high-speed roads and so on. When you're in the older parts of town or more developed, dense areas like downtown Chicago, you have a grid pattern of roads, whereas when you're out in the suburbs, when you're out in some of the metro areas, the outer parts of those areas, you are on some of those high-speed roads, and there's a lot of reliance on arterial roads to get to where you're going from point A to point B. We're seeing a lot of crashes disproportionately for people who are maybe lower-income workers trying to get out to their jobs that only can be accessible with these busier roads.
And James, what does it look like in Champaign? I know, for example, there's lots of students that cycle around Champaign. There's lots of other bike trails in the greater central Illinois area. What are you seeing and hearing?
We're seeing a lot of new riders learning to ride, a lot of seasoned riders who are very comfortable. They're very appreciative of new infrastructure, but the newer riders don't know how to use it. As much as the local municipalities have been trying to make it very apparent, you know, in their signage, in the way it's painted on the roads, there's really zero education on how to ride a bike in traffic. And so that's one of the major hurdles.
We're going to talk about that in a minute, James. Thanks for pointing that out. I wanted to just point out to both of you, gentlemen, Illinois actually ranks 16th in the United States in terms of being a bicycle-friendly state. That's according to the Department of Transportation in a 2017 bicycle-friendly state ranking. Ed, what do you make of that ranking?
I think we can do better. You know, I think there are ways in which education, which James alluded to, could push us higher into the top 10 at least. He did mention about education, and I think that's true. You know, our schools are not really teaching bike safety to kids. a driver's ed maybe covers the very basics on how to bicycle in the presence of, or how to drive in the presence of bicycles. And that's something that there are tools out there. For example, our organization has a resource called bikesafetyquiz.com with short lessons on common crash types, the relevant laws, with modules that you can take in 20 minutes for drivers, for adult cyclists, and for child cyclists. There's a big education gap, and I think by closing that gap, we can move up those rankings.
And Ed, how much do you think the education gap is among drivers? I'm just thinking about the fact that I actually recently just took my Illinois driver's license exam again as I was transferring licenses, and there was nothing about cyclists on that exam. There was nothing about cycling safety. There were lots of signs and questions, but there was nothing about cycling. Is that something you think drivers, adult drivers, are also not being taught?
Yeah, I think, you know, it really wasn't taught that heavily in driver's ed whenever we took driver's ed, no matter the age of the driver. So that has been an issue. And I know when the driver's test is given by the Secretary of State, there's a pool of questions. There might be one or two that are bike and pedestrian related, but it's a big pool of questions, and it's possible that you're not even tested on it. So, you know, that is an issue. People make mistakes out there. They don't know how to avoid the common crash types. Marnie mentioned crosswalks, and there are issues with that. So, you know, we like to point people to bikesafetyquiz.com to catch some of that info that they maybe missed in driver's ed or maybe missed in their elementary schools when they learned about how to bike.
And let's just do a little bit of that driver safety ed here. James, I wonder if you could just let us know let's start with drivers. What are basic rules for drivers when they're sharing the road with cyclists? For example, how far apart do you need to be from a cyclist if you're sharing the road with them?
Well, to share the road, you cannot drive next to them. You can only pass them. You need about 3 feet. Every rider hopes for a little bit more, but the minimum is 3 feet. You want to leave a good stopping distance. And you want to make sure if you are going to overtake them, not to do it too soon. If there's like a stop sign ahead to cause kind of a conflict and have a double lane issue. We often have drivers trying to share a lane, and that we cannot have because it's not safe.
Okay. Ed, anything else you want to add to that from a driver standpoint?
Yeah, there's common crash types. One's called a right hook, the other's called a left cross, and they're intersection issues where drivers often misjudge the speed of cyclists and maybe cut them off, either an oncoming cyclist or a cyclist that's going the same direction as they are when the driver makes a right turn. So judging the speed of cyclists is a key. Another one is, as was mentioned by Marnie, is crosswalks. A lot of our roads are designed so that the stop lines are way too far back. The crosswalks are too far back. So if you're someone walking or someone bicycling off-road, you're really trusting that motorist is going to stop at the stop line. That is actually a major cause of crashes.
James, what about common safety issues that cyclists are getting wrong? You mentioned beginning cyclists.
Yeah, so we see a lot of cyclists in the Champaign-Urbana area who are new either to cycling or even to the country. And we see them being very fearful of the road, and they prefer to ride on the sidewalk, which is incredibly dangerous. In a lot of places, it's illegal.
In a lot of places, it's illegal, I was going to say, too. Right.
Yeah, and what that does is it takes you out of the motorist's view. They focus on the road, as they should. They don't watch the sidewalk. And so we have cyclists who will stop, believe they're part of traffic on the sidewalk, and then go into an intersection where, as you know, Ed's talking about, you can have a right hook. They will cross a entrance or an exit to a building or a business, and because they're moving at a much faster pace than a pedestrian, the motorist won't see them in time. That's one of the main issues. We have a lot of wrong way riders here on campus. We also get a lot of people who do not use bike lights.
So wrong way riders, you're saying on campus in Champaign-Urbana, they're running. So they're going down a one way street the wrong direction. Is that what you mean?
That is correct. We do also have some simply riding on the wrong side of the road into traffic. There is a common misconception that you should ride your bicycle against traffic, similar to walking. And so for walking in a place where there's no sidewalk or heavy traffic, you would walk to the side of the road so that you can see the oncoming motorists. With cyclists, because you are a part of traffic, you should ride on the correct side with traffic. And that's kind of a persistent misconception.
And I imagine for both of you gentlemen, we haven't talked about helmets. I imagine both of you think helmets are a necessity when you're cycling?
Correct.
Oh, sure. You absolutely need that.
Mm-hmm. We just have about a minute or so left. James, I wonder if I could just ask you, what's at the top of your wish list for change when it comes to cycling safety as we look at these statistics from a couple of years ago and as we talk about education?
For me, it would be an equal percentage of funding with driving and infrastructure. And we've got, you know, over 99% of infrastructure and education is focused solely on motorized transportation. And if we could bump up the funding, the city and the states that we have here, they know how to educate. They know how to build infrastructure. But we repeatedly see funding gaps. We don't have a lot of employees that are focused on this. We don't have a lot of employee time. And so if we could bring the funding up for the states and the cities within the transportation budget, they can figure this out. They're very intelligent. They're very forward-thinking. And that would resolve, again, you know, the education, which we, you know, we desperately need for cyclists and drivers. But we don't have funding for Safe Routes to School, an excellent program that we need in every school.
That's James Rydell. I want to thank him. He's with Neutral Cycle in Champaign. I want to thank Ed Barsotti with Ride Illinois. We'll tweet out, by the way, that bike safety quiz if you follow us at 21ST Show. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Guns and gun laws are sadly making headlines again this week with people on both sides of the debate. And one state we should add before the church shooting massacre in Texas has moved to expand gun ownership rights. Last week, Wisconsin State Assembly proposed legislation that would allow any resident to hunt regardless of age.
If you don't think they're ready under the age of 10, then please don't take them. This gives the choice back to the parent.
Thanks to Wisconsin Public Radio for that audio of Republican Representative Rob Staff-Holtz. Currently, you have to be at least 12 years old to purchase a hunting license in Wisconsin, 10 to go along with a supervised adult. What's the law here in Illinois? If you're under 18, you need to have a youth hunting license and be with an adult who has valid hunting and gun permits. So what does this mean for Wisconsin, and why is it important for legislators to enable children to hunt? Sean Johnson has been reporting on this for Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Sean.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sean, did this bill originate from Representative Staff-Holtz?
It did, but I think it's very similar to other bills that we see in the Wisconsin legislature, where there has been just an overall push by lawmakers to embrace Wisconsin's hunting heritage, and as part of that, to try to get more young people involved in hunting.
And so, how much support is this getting then? If this is something that you said is part of sort of people embracing the hunting culture, I imagine this is getting a lot of support from people?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a polarizing issue, I'd say. Yes, there is general support for hunting in Wisconsin from both parties. But when it comes to this issue and the absolutely real prospect that, you know, a five-year-old could be out on a hunt with an adult, and they could both be carrying guns,
that definitely rubs some lawmakers the wrong way, even lawmakers who like to hunt or who have taken their older kids out on hunting through Wisconsin's mentorship program. They feel like what's happening here is just a little bit too far.
In fact, Sean, there's one representative we have audio of who was very passionately against this, Gary Hebel from Sun Prairie, that's near Madison. Let's hear what he had to say on the floor.
The insanity of having two guns and a kid at any age. I mean, look what's going on in our country. And look at the direction you're taking on safety. Absolute insanity.
And so is this something, Sean, he's a Democrat. Is this a vote that's going along party lines? Or how are you seeing this vote kind of play out?
So it's been mostly along party lines here in Wisconsin. Republicans have big majorities in our state assembly and our state senate. They also have the governor's office. But you did see four Democrats join most Republicans in voting yes on this bill. You also saw three Republicans joining most Democrats in voting no. So not like a huge amount of crossover there, but it is indicative that this is, you know, one of those issues that when you talk about letting kids of any age hunt, those usual party lines crack a little bit.
Sean, do you have a sense of how this compares to other hunting laws around the country? As I mentioned, here in Illinois, you have to be 18 unless supervised. Is removing an age limit on hunting something that's considered radical?
You know, according to at least the number that the Associated Press was reporting, 34 other states have no minimum hunting age. And they got that number from the Wisconsin Hunters' Rights Coalition. So, you know, in that sense, it's not unusual if that is indeed the case. I think it's a pretty big step for Wisconsin, though, because what we're talking about here is a mentored hunt. And right now, under current law, a kid as young as 10 can go on a mentored hunt with an adult, and they can take one gun between them. And that is something that, I mean, Wisconsin had recently lowered its age to 10 to try to get more kids involved. So they already kind of took that step. What this would do is say there'd be no age restriction, and that the 10-year-old restriction is, you know, that's not the government's to set, according to Representative Rob Stafshold and other Republican supporters, that should be set by the parents. Another significant step is it would also say that you wouldn't have to have just one gun on that mentored hunt, that the kid could have a gun and the adult could have a gun. So you could have, you know, absolutely could have a 5-year-old on a hunt and a parent on a hunt, both carrying guns.
Sean, we just have about a minute left, but I have to ask if the atmosphere around these discussions on this issue have changed after the tragic shooting events we saw on Sunday in Texas.
We're going to get a chance to see, because this passed last week in the state assembly before the shooting in Texas. It's up for the state senate today, where it's likely to pass as well. But, you know, a pretty big event happened in between those votes. So we'll see how that affects things. Of course, you know, the shooting in Texas is just the latest of many in the United States. So that issue has been out there. And, you know, as you heard some Democrats say last week, there's this culture out there with guns and you know, these horrific shootings, and this is the direction that we're going. They don't like that, but when it comes to hunting, you know, there are some exceptions made in Wisconsin.
Right, and I think there are many who would say there's a distinction between hunting and these mass shootings, and of course there are people on the other side of the debate that argue the opposite. We will keep everyone updated. We'll give you an update tomorrow for our audience on how the vote goes. I want to thank Sean Johnson from Wisconsin Public Radio for joining us. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. One of the most explosive political events of the 20th century happened exactly 100 years ago. A century ago, leftist revolutionaries led by Vladimir Lenin seized post offices, railroad stations, and banks, effectively grabbing power from the provisional government and establishing communist control. A bloody civil war broke out shortly after that Russian Revolution in 1918, including the infamous execution of the Tsar and the Romanov family by the Bolsheviks. Today marks the centennial of the Bolshevik uprising, but you wouldn't know it judging from Russia's current government. In the past, the anniversary was known as Revolution Day and typically featured grand military parades and demonstrations in Red Square in Moscow. This year, however, the Kremlin has tiptoed around the anniversary and avoided making big commemoration announcements. Russian President Vladimir Putin's in a particularly tricky position. As a former KGB agent, he can't really denounce the violent revolution that paved the way for the Soviet Union. And as a leader who tries to extinguish uprisings before they happen, he can't really celebrate it either. Why are we talking about all of this on the 21st? Well, it turns out one of the premier experts on Russia's revolutionist history makes his home right here in Illinois. University of Illinois professor Mark Steinberg is actually with me in our Chicago studios. He's going to be talking about the Bolshevik Revolution. Revolution Centennial this weekend at the Chicago Humanities Festival, and he's also the author of a new book, The Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1921, which offers a fresh perspective on those tumultuous events from a century ago. Hi, Mark. Thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much.
So I think if we remember our history, we remember it as the October Revolution. Why is November 7th the day that's celebrated?
So it actually reminds me because when I first studied this years ago as an undergraduate, the professor started the class saying, the great October Socialist Revolution is what we're going to talk about today. And it was none of the above. Not great. Not an October, not socialist, not even a revolution. So it was October, the non-October, why we celebrate it on November 8th, is because they were 13 days behind on their calendar. Because they used the Julian, we used the Gregorian. And one of the things the revolutionaries did, almost symbolic, I think, is to leap ahead in history. It's like, we're behind, but now we're going to catch up to the rest of the world through our revolution. So they changed the calendar. They adopted the Western calendar.
So this is I imagine they were following an Eastern Orthodox calendar. Is that what they were following before?
Correct. The Julian calendar was the one that the Eastern Church kept.
And the revolution literally changed time in Russia.
It literally changed time.
We're at the 100-year mark. Yep. You were recently in Russia, and I wonder how people there feel about this milestone today. And I'm thinking about everyday people, although I think I'm sure as you know better than I do, I would imagine Russians are sort of notorious about not expressing a lot of public opinions about this, right?
Well, that's changed.
Yeah.
In Soviet times, when I first started living there, they don't want to talk, certainly not to somebody clearly from another country. They didn't even know which country I was. It didn't matter because I speak Russian, but not with a Russian accent. So, you know, my cab driver's take on this is like, you're here for a conference on the Russian Revolution? And then I say, yeah, and religion and the Russian Revolution. He said, oh, religion's good, revolution bad. So, you know, at the bottom level of society, for most people, the main thing they remember, it was a catastrophe. It was tragedy. People suffered, and there were a lot of bad politicians. And sometimes when people are saying that, I think they're saying, and look at it now, bad politicians, bad things happening. So there's a weird way, and I think for a lot of ordinary Russians, their life has just been one disaster after another.
Right, it's just sort of one series of misery and
exactly.
Other events, right?
But then if you go look at the top, right, what Putin says, so as you say, Putin has a lot of anxiety about talking about revolution, but he sort of has two ideas. One idea is that everything that's ever happened in Russia has to be good because we are a good country. It's all ours. It all belongs to us. And so let's talk about it honestly, but let's also remember, when we do talk about it honestly, is that anything that pulls people apart, anything that is about disagreement, is a bad thing because national unity is the only thing that matters. So he says it's okay to talk about
it. Those are very complicated messages in there to distill out from a public perspective, right?
On the other hand, you know, it may seem very far-fetched, but, you know, look at debates about the Civil War in the United States. Where people say, hey, you know, both sides were, they all were doing something positive. They were doing their best. And people similarly don't want to see what takes away from national unity. So for Russians, especially at the top, anything that divides people is bad. And the Russian Revolution was all about people being divided and at each other's throats.
So I want to get back to present day, but let's go back to 100 years ago. And I wonder if you can just remind everyone And I think everyone has, I think everyone will have at least a top level remembrance of their global history high school lessons, right? But I wonder if you can just remind us, first of all, what the Bolshevik Revolution was. Can we start back there before we get to what its significance is today, if you can separate the two?
Oh, yeah, easily. I'm a historian. I like talking about the past. The trouble with being a historian is, where does anything begin, right? I mean, every event has its deep roots. But not to begin history at the beginning of the time, which is the way some historians would want to do it, is the Bolshevik Revolution only makes sense because of the February Revolution that happened in February, which of course was really March.
So that was, but we're still in 1917.
We're still in 1917. See, I'm not going that far back.
Okay.
So in February of 1917, the Tsar, the Emperor of Russia, was toppled from power in the midst of World War I, in the midst of a economic catastrophe, in the midst of a huge strike movement, and as it happened on International Women's Day, because large numbers of women and women workers were in the streets. And workers came out and joined them in large numbers. And the Tsar sent messages, tell people to go home. And if they don't, shoot at them. So that attack on masses in the streets who were demanding things like improve the economy, give us bread, end the war, that brought the Tsar down. And it brought a new government to power, which you mentioned, the Provisional Government, which was a government of left-wing liberals and, after a couple of months, a socialist complicated process, but socialists joined the government. In fact, by the eve of the October Revolution, this government had a majority of socialists, with only one socialist party not there, and that's the Bolsheviks.
So there was disagreement then, obviously. Again, I'm not going to, I feel like I'm going to could keep saying history repeats itself, but we're not going to talk about sort of disagreements. We'll get to sort of today versus back then. There weren't, and it's interesting to look back 100 years ago when we think about the Bolshevik Revolution, we think because they won that everybody agreed with them. But at the time, that wasn't the case.
So, you know, it's interesting. I mean, one argument is the Bolsheviks were a tiny minority, nobody supported, and they seized power in a coup. And that is a legitimate historical argument. I actually don't agree with that based on the evidence. So what's happening in the course of those months from February to October, or March to November in our calendar, is that people had very high expectations. The Tsar was gone. The liberals had come to power. Complete freedoms were declared. Civil rights were declared. And they promised to improve people's life. The trouble is the economy continues to disintegrate. The war continues to go on. And people's frustrations are growing. And what's happening in the course of those months, one of the reasons socialists are a majority is because the government kept collapsing and being reformed. And more left-wing people were joining the government to address people's anxiety. But by the eve of the October Revolution, so 100 years ago, people were so frustrated with the war continuing, the economy disintegrating, they felt they weren't getting what they expected. Now, one might say, give us time. You know, it's only been 7 months. But people were suffering, really suffering. And so there are lots and lots of signs, not in the masses of the country, but in the cities throughout the Russian Empire, that especially workers and also soldiers at the front and in the garrisons were voting for Bolsheviks to be the majority and favorite party in this group called the Workers' Councils. The Soviets is the Russian word for it. And they were winning elections, and people were flowing into the Bolshevik Party. So at least in a certain segment of the population, mainly urban workers, people were saying the Bolsheviks are going to have to be the ones we turn to because everybody else has failed us. Everybody else has disappointed us.
I want to talk about the elections and people who were voting for Bolsheviks in a minute, but we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Mark Steinberg. He's the author of The Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1921. He also teaches history at the University of Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Mark Steinberg. He's a history professor at the University of Illinois. He's actually going to be speaking this weekend about the Bolshevik Revolution, which has its 100th anniversary today. He's speaking about that in Chicago at the Chicago Humanities Festival. We're talking to him now about this incredible milestone, right? If you think about 100 years, Mark. And I want to go back to what you were just saying before the break about the Bolsheviks offering hope for a lot of people. So there were, in the provisional government, there were elections. People were voting, and people were voting for the Bolsheviks?
Well, for the provisional government, they're an interesting government that way because they were never elected, which is why they call themselves provisional. So they were what was left over of the old Tsarist parliament. They simply chose to declare them, somebody had to be in charge. They declared themselves a government. Parallel was a parallel government of which was elected, but in a very informal way in the so-called Soviets, which meant councils. And workers and soldiers were sending representatives, and by the end of the year, or peasants as well. And they had city Soviets and neighborhood Soviets and a national Soviet as well. So it's in the Soviets, oddly, these worker councils that were having elections, whereas the liberal government never had an election. They were waiting for a big constituent assembly, which was going to happen in January. They actually held the elections in November, in which there was a national election. The outcome of that's rather interesting. But in the Soviets, you could have an election any day, anytime people were in the right mood, have a new election. And so that's where it's like week by week, you can reelect your representatives when you were frustrated with them. So that's where you could see this constant shift where Bolsheviks were becoming more and more successful in elections to these councils, these Soviets.
And then what leads to the actual coup then? If they're becoming more successful, why was there a coup?
So people call it dual power. There were basically the real government, the legal government, which is the provisional government, which was in charge of the politics. And then there is this parallel government that represents only the working classes and soldiers and peasants. And a lot of radical socialists were part of it. In fact, all the socialists in the provisional government had come out of the Soviets initially. So one government has power. One might say official state power, and the other has power on the street because they have so much strong popular support. So when it gets to late October and everybody's more and more frustrated, it's exactly at this point, late in the middle of the night on the beginning of November 8th, after midnight, that this National Congress of Soviets with representatives from all over the country, all over the empire, are meeting. And they're thinking about what to do. And the Bolsheviks have been running around saying for the last several weeks, let's give all power to the Soviets. Let's get rid of the provisional government and make the Soviets the government. And all the moderate socialists who were still there, they said, no, we can't do that. That would be a disaster. You know, in the midst of war, in the midst of economic catastrophe, to have a bunch of workers and soldiers run the country. But the Bolsheviks insisted that's the only salvation. And every time the Bolsheviks were winning elections, it's because they said, let's ignore the bourgeoisie. Let's ignore the upper classes. We can rule the country. People's power was what we might call it now. And so on this day, when the meeting, but early in the morning, pre-dawn, and they're having this council, the Bolsheviks decided they don't want to wait for what the council will decide, what the National Soviet, because they might decide the wrong thing. Let's take state power by seizing all those buildings, especially in Petrograd, the capital, and then there'll be uprisings in other cities. Let's seize the state and show up with a fait accompli. That's what Trotsky called it, who was in charge of this. Trotsky was the leader of the insurrection. Let's tell them, by the way, we've just seized state power for you. Do you want it? And, of course, at that meeting, they walk in and they say, well, we've seized state power. It's all power to the Soviets. And all the moderates say, outrageous. How dare you? You're starting a civil war. And what did they do? The worst thing they could have done, they walked out. And the Bolsheviks, Trotsky famously said, good riddance. See you all on the trash heap of history. That's where you belong. Go. And they left the Bolsheviks in charge.
And they did kind of, he was right.
They were on the trash heap of history. Who remembers the Mensheviks and the socialist revolutionaries? They basically left the Bolsheviks in charge, who created a one-party government.
I'm speaking with University of Illinois Professor Mark Steinberg. We're talking about the Bolshevik Revolution. And Mark, your book, The Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1921, doesn't just focus on the nuts and bolts of history that we've been talking about, because you work hard to try to get a feel for the time and a sense of what people were thinking and experiencing. So by November 8th, I mean, the country was in pretty bad shape. Things were not going well. So I wonder if you can give us a sense of how much hope people had. And I guess, and by that I mean, I guess that there's going to be different sectors of Russian society, right? So let's maybe we could go through those and how everybody mm-hmm. felt about the revolution.
So it's useful to think about. That's a really interesting question. It's useful to think about it in comparison with February, because it is true. I'm trying to understand what the experience was like, what it felt like, and what people hoped for and desired or feared. So after February, everybody described the country as feeling like Easter, and an Orthodox Easter with a, you know, it's dark and the lights go on and Christ has come back symbolically.
A really big deal.
Yeah. Huge and happy yeah. and joyous. And there's endless accounts after the February Revolution when the Tsar fell. People rushed into the streets and they're embracing each other and they're kissing strangers. And they're talking about, oh, my God, the history of the world has just changed. It was sheer joy and celebration. Months of frustration passed. Then comes October. To be sure, many, many people favored Bolshevik power, or rather, nobody favored Bolshevik power. Everybody favored Soviet power, but only the Bolsheviks were in favor of it. So by implication, it was for the Bolsheviks. But the idea was let the Soviets come to power. And, you know, the mood is really different. People aren't going into the streets kissing and hugging and celebrating and declaring freedom has won. I get the sense, even among the most avid supporters of the Bolsheviks and Soviet power, that they were more or less terrified as to what lay ahead. This was a huge gamble. They know how many bad things had happened in the course of 1917 and the risks of the Western powers intervening, the war losing to the Germans, the economy collapsing. People were feeling a sense of bold daring, the supporters were, but anxiety. And for a huge part of the population, they were feeling a sense of, I don't think this is a good idea. It's like the Mensheviks and SRs who walk out saying, we're going to have a civil war, which is true that we did. So then you say, break it down, right? Intellectuals say it's time to leave the country, unless they were Bolsheviks. Huge numbers are leaving. Artists, writers, thinkers, and the like. Massive outflow. Except for those who thought, they won't last. We'll just wait it out. Workers were mostly supportive, but anxious. But they had a very concrete demand. We want food. We want our factories to get started because a lot had stopped. And we want to run the factories ourselves, kick out the managers, kick out the foremen. And so the most immediate thing, they can't give themselves food. They require the government to do that, but they could take over the factories. And a lot of them are beginning to run factories on their own. So they were pretty happy for a while. They were still waiting for food. In the countryside, peasants got the message really quickly. The provisional government said, peasants had one demand. We want all the land. We work it. Why should anybody own it? Why should we pay rent? It's all ours. And they were beginning to take it. And the Bolsheviks, when they came to power, one of the first things they passed three resolutions exactly 100 years ago today. One was for peace, to declare the war will be over. The other was for all the peasants. Peasants should take all the land for themselves. And the peasants were delighted. It's like, I don't know. Most of them said, Bolsheviks? Never heard of them. Never heard of that party. Who are those people? But let's take all the land. Thank you.
You said there were three things.
Three things.
Yeah.
Yes. So the
what was
other,
the third one?
The other was this workers' control. They actually declared that it is that factories should run their own factories. However, when the Bolsheviks said workers' control, they didn't mean they should own their own factories. They meant just manage them, have an influence, supervise the employers, not workers' ownership. But a lot of workers just took control means we're totally in control. So one might say the first thing the Bolsheviks did is they declare, take the land, take the factories, and we promise peace. That was the hard part. And actually, the demand for bread, they had no idea how they were going to make the economy work. So this is the beginnings of the danger.
How did the rest of the can you remind us how the rest of the world, especially the United States, reacted in 1917 to this?
So, you know, communists were known. This wasn't an unknown movement in across the world. And there were two aspects. One is communists have, I mean, you can look at like American newspapers, communists seize power in Russia. This was terrible because if communists could seize power in one of the biggest countries in Europe, to be sure at the East, that's going to encourage communists in every country. And so one was there was a real anxiety. This would encourage a communist movement. The other was we have a war to fight. And the Germans are a terrible, terrible threat. And Russia promises to pull itself out of the war because there's only one way to get out of the war, and that is to leave. You know, the Russians had this idea we'd do a peace conference and negotiate solutions, but nobody was interested. They were still fighting. So they said, so let's pull out. And the idea, what if Russia pulled out of the war and then the Germans won? And so there was real anxiety that this was undermining the war effort. So American troops showed up in Russia. French troops showed up in what became Soviet Russia to try to, one, keep supplies heading to their armies that were all over Europe. And, of course, the U.S. only joined the war in 1917, so it had barely got there. But the other was, let's see if we can help the opponents of the Bolsheviks bring the government down. So it was called the intervention, and they supported the white, as they were called, the white armies of monarchists trying to restore the old government, even bring the Tsar back.
Today's the centennial of the 1917 Communist Revolution in Russia. We've been speaking about that with University of Illinois Professor Mark Steinberg. And I'm thinking there's actually a lot of Russian-related events going on in Illinois right now. Mark, you're presenting this weekend at the Chicago Humanities Festival. The Art Institute in Chicago downtown has an exhibition on Soviet art as well. Mark, why do you think Russia is so fascinating a topic to people in the United States? Not even talking about current events and how often we're talking about Russia these days.
Yeah, I mean, one, it's hard not to think in terms of current events, but I'm not thinking about the current events, the interference in the election and all of that. But, you know, we've spent how many years of most of us living through the Cold War or its immediate aftermath? And at the center of the Cold War is, of course, the Soviet Union. I mean, China wouldn't be where it is today. Cuba wouldn't be a communist country that it was for a while, maybe still is. Anti-colonial movements in Latin America, everything that happened in most of the 20th century in some ways connects to the Russian Revolution. And so I think it was inevitably that it became an immediate topic. And it, for me as a Russian historian, I'm glad Russia still makes trouble in the world because we pay attention to it. But that's part of it, is their political role. The other is, to be honest, you know, if you read Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or Chekhov, or you watch Russia, you pay attention to ballet or music, you know, apart from the political significance of the Russian Revolution, Russia itself has a deep curiosity, attractiveness. It's been part of the center of the Western world and also of the rest of the world for a very long time. I mean, you can go in almost any country in the world and say, oh, I love Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or whoever it is. So I think there's something about Russia that speaks to us, both politically and one might say culturally.
I wonder, as you're studying Russia's past, if you find parallels with the present, if you think there are what interesting parallels you would draw. Are there any?
It's hard. You know, history does not repeat. It's always different. When I'm thinking about the connection of, let's just say, the Russian Revolution, you can pick any time in Russian history to draw connections, and you're thinking about how it connects to our world. The thing that actually, and it's one of the reasons my book ends with a chapter called Utopians, and I actually challenge the notion, utopia is just a fantasy of what can't be. And you mentioned the word hope, and I think for me that's what really is compelling. The odds were against success, every aspect of the Russian Revolution. The provisional government should have probably given up. There was no way they could do what they wanted. And the Bolsheviks should give up. They should have given up. I mean, the chances of achieving a world of real freedom and real equality and true justice at every level, from social to gendered to personal, the odds are against it, actually. And yet people tried and struggled, and some died, to achieve that sort of world. And that was what inspired them, nothing but hope. Hope that went beyond the realm of reality. And in a way, I think that's actually relevant to our world. There's a lot of reasons to be depressed and to think no matter what you want, it's not going to work out. Everything's going to work out badly. And to actually hope enough to take a chance to try to achieve some of those high ideals, to me, is actually the relevance of the Russian Revolution to our day.
I'm afraid we're out of time, but I appreciate you joining us, University of Illinois Professor Mark Steinberg. His book is called The Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1921. We'll tweet out details of all of the events that Mark is also taking part in if you're in the Chicago area. Mark, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Real pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
That's all the time we have for today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.